Namaste Sarasvati Deva Gauravani Prachadane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastati Desha Tarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shusti Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So yesterday I went over the general definition of bhakti Anya Abhilashita Shunya with its details, and I covered the first two qualities of bhakti, those which manifest on the level of sadhana bhakti. Krishna Chakravarti also gives the example of the plant, just as Lord Chaitanya gives the example of the bhakti lata being planted by Guru in Krishna's mercy, and then it grows up. So in relation to that, he says that bhakti grows up like a plant, but a plant, as it grows out of the ground, as a sprout, then it has two little leaves that come out, first of all. So then he calls these leaves kleshagni and subhada. In other words, it's not the ultimate manifestation of the plant. What's the ultimate manifestation of the plant? It's fruit. But on the way, we get the leaves coming out, then we get the flower, and then we get the fruit. So in Madhura Kadambani, he says that the first two qualities are like the leaves, the first two leaves. And the second stage, as Bhav Bhakti, is like the flowers, and the fruit is like prema. So that's kind of an interesting example to remember. But he also mentions there that the interesting thing about this plant is that a normal plant, you get a fruit, a flower, and then that turns into a fruit, and the flower dies, obviously, because it becomes a fruit. But in this plant, that doesn't happen. All the qualities of the leaves remain, the flowers remain, and the fruit remain simultaneously, even though the fruit has come out. So in other words, that means that all these qualities remain in the final stage as well. It's not that the first two disappear, and then the second two disappear, and then only the last qualities in prema are there. No, all the qualities are present in prema itself. Okay? So, but the first two begin to manifest in sadhana bhakti. This is natural, of course. When we follow any process, we should get some result when we start it. If we get some result only at the end, it may be very discouraging for us. If after five lifetimes you're going to get a result of what you do in this lifetime, and no one's going to do it. You would have to have a lot of faith to let everything come only after five lifetimes or so. So Krishna also manifests some results along the way for bhakti. So in sadhana bhakti, therefore, we get some results. These results, of course, are not final. They're in relation actually to our material condition. In other words, it's clearing out the ignorance and the kama, etc., and manifesting some of the qualities of the soul. So it's not a final condition at all, but it's a gradual manifestation of this spiritual quality of the jiva. However, even in doing so, in this stage, it is still superior to other spiritual processes. They also may have some, you know, kleshagni of some sort. They may also have some subhada also. But they're not the same thing. And that was shown how the kleshagni is not complete in karmakanda or in gyanakanda or in yoga. It is only complete in bhakti. And similarly, subhada. Everything gives subha. You can get material subha by doing karma. You can get moksha. That is another type of subha, sukha. But the sukha of bhakti is different. The soul gets satisfaction in its relationship with Krishna, even though it's at the beginning stage. Still, there's a difference there. Okay, so we covered these two things. In relation to that, though it's not mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion so much, it is a little confusing for people concerning these definitions. That is the particularly the Pabij, Papa, Aparabdha, Kuta Bija Parabdha. There's all sorts of different explanations for that, what that means and whatever. Because the Pat Bij, in one sense, sounds like the same as the Bij mentioned in Kuta Bija, but it's a different thing. If we look in the Nectar Devotion, how Rupa Goswami analyzes it, he says the causes are three. Avidya, Pat Bij, and Papa. And then Papa has Aparabdha, Kuta Bija, Prarabdha. So that Bija is different from the Pat Bija. It's not the same thing. So we should make that distinction first. So, the other point is that sometimes we may think that the confuse the issue in this development of from the Papa to the Aparabdha, Kuta Bija, Prarabdha. What happens there? So, some people have the idea that the Kuta and the Bija are more or less desire, a stage of desire. And then from desires, then we do more activities, etc. However, we already have desire there as a pap bija, which causes the action. That's already there. So therefore, when we go aparabdha, that stage there is only a manifestation of the suffering or happiness also. We get to punyas, then it's aparabdha, kuta, bija, parabdha. Then we get some happiness we don't even strive for, we get something. Similarly, we do a sinful activity, then gradually it goes from unseen aparabdha to kuta to bija to parabdha. Then we suffer physically. Yeah? So it's only in the stages we go through. So in other words, when we talk about aparabdha and parabdha karmas, we're talking about conditions, inescapable conditions that we're put into. We're not talking about our desire. Never the desire is there, definitely. And it goes along with the jiva. We do an activity in this lifetime. We die. Then we get the result somewhere in the future for that. That's the aparabdha, kuta, bija, parabdha. We also have desire that goes along with us in any case because our mind goes with us. And all the activities we've done in this lifetime also give us desires and hatred. That goes along with you anyway. It's not actually a karma. It's just the some results of all your activities of this lifetime plus the previous lifetimes. That subtle body, your mind, goes with you anyway. So it's not a reaction. The reaction is to the activities you do. Then you get some result in the future. So the distinction between your sinful desires and the sinful reaction. You should make a distinction there. Otherwise we get a little bit confused about the issue. So here it's talking about aparabdha, kuta, bija, parabdha. That's simply the stages of the reaction. In terms of unmanifest to manifest state. They're both there. Yeah. The reactions, the aparabdha is, how does the aparabdha go with us? It goes with us in our subtle body. And it is stored there a lot. In other words, in our subtle body, we have, you know, the mind, intelligence, ego, and then in the mind we have all our desires and hatreds, etc. Impressions, so many things are there, memories, etc. Plus, we also get the karmas stored there. The aparabdha, kuta, bija are stored there. So at a certain point, the mind will be able to access those reactions. That's why you can have intuition maybe of your future, what's going to happen, disaster or whatever. Because it's sitting there somewhere in your subtle body. And you can access it if you've got the ability sometimes. Or if it's getting close to you, it becomes a bija, kuta bija, parabdha. It's getting very close, then you can pick it up. And finally, it manifests. Or you may get a dream or whatever also. So subtle, it's not gross yet. And when it's gross, then it is parabdha. It's used in both ways in scripture. Sometimes it's used to refer to both, sometimes to one or the other. Papa, in other words, may refer to the action itself. He's done a papa. he's done a sinful activity. But then usually in scripture, Papa also refers to the reaction. Obviously it includes it, because every time you do a Papa, you get a reaction for it. So Pap Karma includes the reaction also. It's the action you do, sinful activity, like killing a person, also the reaction. You know, the whole thing is included. And sometimes this refers to the reaction. So it's according to the usage of the term. Sometimes it's a little confusing because of that. So in other words, if we say that your karma is your desires also that go with you, then the question will come, then where's my free will? Because all my desires are predetermined and I can't change them because I must have these desires due to my previous karmas, then I'm not responsible. If due to my desires, I do sinful activities. So we get caught in this position of having everything predetermined for us, and then we can't do anything. There's no free will. So that's why the karmas, which you must inevitably get, are simply the reactions or conditions you put into in this lifetime. Your desires are also coming with you, but those you can change. Usually by association. You can change those. On our own, it's very difficult to change. With association, we change for the better or worse. Bad association, the desires will get worse. Good association, then they'll improve.
Could you just clarify again the three stages of the three causes of suffering?
Avidya, papija, and then papa, which has.
So she said there's a difference between the papija and the
bija.
Reaction to
papa. Yeah, because papija refers to desire. That gives rise to the action of papa. In other words, the seed of sinful action is the desire to do it. It's a kama. And it's side product, krodha. Kama and krodha. They give us action, or papa. And then it starts giving results in the future lifetimes in terms of aparabdha, kuta, bija, parabdha.
So that bija, that's a result, it's not the same?
No, it's different. It's a manifestation of your reaction.
Yeah, but
is it still desire? No, let's say I kill somebody. So I'll get a reaction in my future life. Maybe I have to live a short lifetime, right? I get an accident when I'm 20 years old and I have to die. So how is it going to manifest as a desire first? A desire to kill somebody again? No, it just simply manifests gradually, and I may get these premonitions of death or something, and then gradually then I die. When I die, that's a parabdha, and aparabdha may be five lifetimes later. So I won't even know about it for two or three, four lifetimes. I won't know about it at all. That's the aparabdha stage. Then gradually, it may hang over me for a little while, and then it gets more and more, you know, dense, and then finally I get it. Death when I'm 20 years old. Yeah. Yeah. And then it becomes an action. And then I get reaction in stages.
And then I'm taking something from the upper up down through the picture.
Yeah.
Still seed, but it's just a seed of
reaction. Yeah, it's a reaction of a seed. A seed of reaction, yeah. And it doesn't hit us, it's a seed of reaction, and then it manifests. It's a full plant.
Seed of reaction,
yeah.
It's not like a simple desire.
No, because that's already covered in Papija. So why would we repeat it twice? Now, I know in the courses it's taught like that, that goes around like that, but that's confusing. It's very confusing.
So in other words, it's like the reaction, but this is in the form.
Yeah, that's all. To make it more clear, otherwise you get very confused about how the desire suddenly fits in there and as a stage of the reaction. So technically what's happening is this. Oops.
Or punya, it's called the punya first. And the punya first volatile at this point, we're getting some reaction from that. Then we get reaction. Right down here. Suffering. Or enjoyment. Well, if you're not even striving for it, it comes to us like that. So this action then, to this point where we get the reaction, this is where we get the aparada, kuja, bija, parada. In other words, very subtle to very gross. So here, and when we get to this stage, maybe we have to get into the mind. Here is in the body. Body and mind. Or here also you can get mind, mental body also, but you use mental and physical. And along with this, in every life, I'm not going to go into a lifetime here. Along with that, this goes down all. Anyway, this is coming down. In all cases. When I have a situation here of enjoyment or suffering, I also have my desires, which will push me in certain directions to do another action.
Prabhupada calls it a great chain. So how does it change? It sits like a line.
Change. Suffering. And then the combination of this plus this that I act gain. Go around this. The desire continues. And when it manifests. Of course, in all these stages, we're taking only one branch, but obviously in every lifetime we have all these stages manifest. And their karmas are in each stage, some are Buddha, some are Prabhupada. And when we get to a situation in our life, we still have our desires and we do activity. And then again, it goes through the whole action again. But we should separate them, because if we put the desire down here, then we're caught and we can't do anything, because our desire is also karma, therefore I can't change it, I must accept it. We can't do anything about it. Therefore, we can blame karma for our actions. And then why I should get a reaction? Karma did not mean. So therefore, the desire is separate. And the vision. So we cannot blame karma for this or this. It's not that we can change by our free will in association with what we use on our own channel. So that gets rid of that scenario of, you know, fatalism and predeterminism and no free will.
Now it's tipping over a little bit. Okay. Just a little note on Subhada. We see here in Subhada that there's four definitions given there. And affection for all living entities, or Jagat Prinan, is there as one of them. And of course Sadguna is another, developing all good qualities. If we examine Krishna's qualities, and we go through all of his different qualities, what's his outstanding quality? Huh? Attractive? Well, what is attractive? His beauty? Is that the most attractive thing? Huh? Affection. Bhakta Vatsalya. That is ultimately his great quality. Huh? He's very affectionate towards his devotees. So, therefore it's natural that the jiva also should reflect that as one of the main qualities in himself. That he'll have great affection for Krishna and also for the jivas. And the other quality of Krishna is he's Satchidananda, full of bliss. Then naturally the jiva should also be happy. I should also have happiness. Okay, so the first two qualities manifest in sadhana bhakti. Second two manifest in bhav bhakti. We've not given the definition of bhav bhakti yet, or prem bhakti. We'll just accept these for now. So the third quality is moksha laguta kriti, or disinterest or disregard for liberation. Yes. Moksha laguta kriti. Lagu means lightness. Lagu as opposed to heavy. Guru and lagu. Lagu means light. So you take it lightly. Moksha is nothing. Insignificant. In the Varna Ashram system, moksha is at the top. Artha, Dharma, Kama, Moksha. And the Brahmana is at the top of the Varnas, and he is striving for moksha. He becomes a sannyasi, and he strives for detachment and getting moksha. So that's the topmost part of the Varna Ashram system, to get liberation from the material world. And this is what the Gyanis and the Yogis strive for, liberation. But if one achieves bhava, then this is nothing. It is not a goal at all. It is useless. Which means that if one attains bhava, that experience, that bliss, is much greater than the bliss of liberation. So therefore, examples are given that when one gets to that stage, the bliss of Brahman is like a drop of water in the desert. Nothing. Compared to the ocean of bhakti. Bhakti rasa medicine. Nothing. So moksha becomes insignificant to the person in bhava bhakti. So in bhava bhakti, one actually gets an experience of Krishna, even if it is temporary, it's not permanent. One may see Krishna once in a lifetime or something like that. Then it's bhava bhakti. But that is enough to give one a realization that moksha without Krishna is useless. It is meaningless. So, of course, Karmakanda, they don't even strive for moksha. They just want to enjoy the material world. But those who are striving for liberation, they reject all of this. They reject all the enjoyment. Artha, Dharma, Kama is all rejected by one striving for moksha. But all of these things, Artha, Dharma, Kama, and moksha, are rejected by the devotee. And one on bhava realizes this, and he considers them all insignificant. So in this way, this is something unique to bhakti, and particularly bhava bhakti. This is the goal, and the jnanis or the yogis will strive for thousands and thousands of lifetimes to get moksha. But the devotee thinks, oh, this is useless. If we don't have a desire? Oh, well, how is it better? Not to have. Well, see, moksha in itself is a desire to get out of the material world and nothing more than that. And if we're Mayavadi, then we want to merge into the Supreme without any qualities. So this is opposite of bhakti, where we're trying to favorably serve the Lord, who has a form and qualities and activities. So therefore, actually, it's offensive. From the devotee's point of view, it's offensive to strive for that moksha. But, naturally, this is also achieved by the devotee. In other words, he gets out of the material world, he gets free from karma, he gets peace, etc. All these things are automatically achieved by the devotee when he achieves the lotus feet of the Lord. But he gets more. But if you only strive for this, that's what you get. According to as you worship, you get. So if you're only striving for moksha, that's what you get. Moksha, no Krishna. You negated Krishna, and it's an aparadi because you reject his form and qualities and activities, and then you're stuck there. And you can't go any further. So that's why the devotees reject it. It's so dangerous for them. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Is that, is it possible that even though it's not on the platform of Bhavan, they actually have this because of Prabhupada's emphasis on this?
That a person before Baba will also have this quality. So that a person before the stage of Baba can also manifest this interest in liberation. That is true. That's, of course, on a philosophical level. We will have that because we read the scriptures and it's here in the Nectar Devotion, other places in the Bhagavatam, etc. It's there. So, yes, we will have that. Every Vaishnava will have that from the very beginning of his training. But it's realized practically on Baba, because there you realize the Lord, and then you see how insignificant is that moksha, practically speaking, directly. So that's why it's put on the Baba level there, that realization, just in terms of realization. But definitely the teaching is there, and that's why we study that now. Okay, any question there? So therefore, moksha is not only considered insignificant, it's also shunned by the devotee. And verses are there in the Nectar Devotion, other places, to show how the devotee is actually served by bhakti and mukti. Yeah, material desire and Durga Devi, let's say, and moksha, they're asking the devotee, how can I serve you? I want to give you something. The devotee says, no, I don't want any of these things. Dangerous for me. Huh? The devotee actually rejects them. He rejects bhakti, of course, because you can fall in the material world and enjoy it. He rejects mukti because it's actually aparadi. It's aparad to get that type of realization. So he doesn't want that either. But they're there. They're begging, let me serve you. So the devotee doesn't even, not only he lightly regards them, but actually he avoids them. Which is opposite of everybody else on spiritual path. They're trying to get liberation, and the devotee's trying to reject it. So this is unique to bhakti. Unique quality of bhakti. Therefore, we also see statements by the devotees that I don't want to get liberated, I don't want Svargaloka, it doesn't matter if I'm in hell even. As long as I can serve the Lord. Okay. So they don't strive for liberation, getting out of their material condition suffering. All they want to do is serve the Lord birth after birth. Okay. So this is the quality of the devotee, not of the jnani or the karmi or the yogi. Okay. So that's number three. Number four is sudurlabha, or very rarely attained. Of course, Krishna says, out of thousands and thousands of people, hardly one knows me in truth. Huh? At the same time, Krishna says, this process is open for everyone. So it looks a little contradictory that bhakti is for everybody. Huh? And we have the Yuga Dharma to make everybody a devotee. And on the other hand, we know that this is very, very rare. But it is rare in two ways. One is, of course, if one, to take to the process of bhakti is rare because, generally one has qualification for that. And one goes from, the plant species to animal species, human species, lower human species, then civilized species, varnashram, then brahminical, and after going through all of that, then finally you realize that higher than all this is to worship the Lord in devotion. The other way, of course, is not to go through that whole process at all, but simply to get the mercy of the devotee somewhere along the way in that path. And then one can get devotion. That also is rare. Yeah? Because not everybody accepts. Of course, the devotee is all merciful, but not everybody accepts the mercy. Yeah? The guru is like the rain cloud, and he sprinkles water everywhere, but not everybody picks it up. Yeah? So the mercy is also rare. Even though the devotee is giving it out, somehow, not everybody picks it up. So in other words, the number of qualified people are the, let's say, fertile fields to accept the seed are not so common. It's quite rare. Among all, if we take all the jivas in the material world, it's rare to practice pure bhakti. And even the devatas, and others. And it's not Uttama Bhakti. It's mixed. To come to pure bhakti. But Uttama Bhakti, that's very, very rare. So, and it's only by that process that you'll go from sadhana, bhava, prema. That progression. If you have mixed bhakti, you won't go that way. You go somewhere else. Krishna won't reveal himself. So to get to the bhava stage, that is, sadhana, of course, is more common. It is uncommon also, but it is more common than bhava. To come to the stage of bhava means one actually will directly see Krishna. That's rare. Even for the sadhana bhaktas. They will do sadhana, but out of all those who do sadhana, then a few will actually directly see Krishna. Even if it's once in a lifetime. They're very rare, rare. Why? One, of course, is that we have to go, generally we have to go through this process. Shraddha. Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya, Anartana Vitti, Nishtha Ruchi, Sakti Bhava. Go to that stage. And even to get to Shraddha, that also takes a long time. Because they have to go through lifetimes of Agyata Sukriti, even to get to Shraddha. So then we have to go all the way up to sadhana until we get to Bhava. That also is not automatic. We have the progress there, but along the way you can get stopped. If you commit offense, then you get stuck. Or you go backwards again. And everything may get destroyed. Or partially destroyed. So it's not automatic that once you start the process, you go off. There can be obstacles along the way. So to get to bhava, ultimately the qualification for bhava is you would have to have ruchi. Not only nishta, you have to get taste, a real taste, which turns into a sakti, one's more intense, and then it goes to bhava. So without that taste for Krishna or Vishnu, then you cannot get the bhava. Now generally, of course, by sadhana, we hope that we go this way and we get nishta, ruchi, sakti, bhava. But it's not automatic. You have to follow a particular way and get mercy along the way from devotees and Krishna. Then you get the ruchi. If you got the ruchi, then we can say you'll get up to bhava. So it's not a mechanical process by any means. So why is it like that? It's explained it's like this because Krishna really doesn't like to give himself to everybody. He doesn't want to become everybody's servant. So therefore he's very careful who gets bhava. But if one does have sincere desire for Krishna and it manifests more and more, then Krishna's heart also melts. So ruchi means we're developing a taste for Krishna. So then Krishna responds with more taste. And then he reveals himself in bhava. So this is only for the devotee, and as the devotee advances and gets to ruchi, then it gets very quickly to bhava. Well, because it's up to Krishna. Simply says, well, I've gone through Shraddha, I got my association, I started my process, I'm doing an Anartana Vritti, and we can't calculate then in 1 year I'm going to have Nishtha, and then 2 years I'll have that. If Krishna's mercy is always necessary somehow or other, and we can't really predict when it's going to happen.
It's not mechanical.
No, it's not mechanical. It ultimately is mercy. But what we can do along the way is, if we have great sincerity and longing, that automatically accelerates the process. So, of course, Krishna also says, I am not attracted to Sankhya, philosophy, or tapas, no matter how much austerities you do. I'm not attracted to that either. Or study, no matter how much you learn, still I'm not attracted to that. But I'm attracted to the bhakti. And bhakti is unpredictable. How do we develop that bhakti? It's not that you can, go and get a book on it or something. The other things, of course, are favorable to bhakti. That is, we do learn Shastra, Bhagavatam, etc. And we follow regulative principles. These are favorable. Still doesn't guarantee. But when that real bhakti begins to develop and development gets strong, then that's a cause for Krishna to also appear. So Krishna does not appear to the Gyanis or the Karmis. That's no question about it. And for the devotees, then he appears in Bhava. Once he sees the sincerity of the devotee. And he's developed his taste. We can say that faith also is a little taste, just a little something. But it has to become stronger and more positive, more and more positive on the jiva's part. When it becomes positive, then Krishna is willing to show himself. Yeah, that's true. If we if somebody has a taste already for Bhagavatam and Krishna, and we associate with that person, that's a good qualification for us for also getting that taste. And that is also explained later in terms of, you know, how we advance. If someone has a taste for Krishna, we associate, then it is likely we'll get a taste, because association is one of the strongest factors in our advancement. Okay, so these bhava is considered, we'll study bhava later, actually is considered a very, very rare stage, even though it is not a complete realization of Krishna. It's a temporary realization of the Supreme Lord, of either Vishnu or Krishna, but it's considered very, very rare. So later on, Rupa Goswami says that even if this person happens to make a mistake, or a fault, or a sin, or a fall down, or whatever, we cannot criticize him, because he's attained such a rare stage. He's already got Krishna's mercy so much. We cannot criticize him. And because he's got Krishna's mercy, Krishna will protect him. And he'll do what is necessary for him in all cases. So we'll leave it up to Krishna, and we cannot say anything about this person. Yeah? So he's this very rare stage, so we should not criticize that person. So Sudurlabha. From bhava, one goes to prema, and in prema, of course, prema is to say intensification of bhava. It's more intense bhava. Bhava means we have an emotional attachment to Krishna that becomes very intense in prema. As a result, any impediments, any obstacles, any impurities, influence of aparads, etc., are completely annihilated. Okay? So in this stage, we get perfection, and there is sandra nanda visheshatma, or condensed bliss. Sandra means condensed. So sandra nanda visheshatma. Visheshatma is explained, we'll explain that later, but it means that there is the hladini and the samvit shaktis of the Supreme Lord himself coming in the jiva at this point. So that we can experience that bliss and have realization of him. Samvit is for spiritual realization. Hladini is for experiencing bliss. So the Lord's energies manifest within the jiva at this time, so he can see Krishna, associate with him, and experience bliss. It begins to manifest in bhava. It is sandra. It is completely manifest in prema. So this type of bliss is completely beyond material enjoyment, because it's eternal and ever-increasing, whereas material bliss is temporary and subject to its opposite, suffering as a result, due to karmas. And it is way beyond moksha, even in bhava. Moksha is lagu dukriti. So what to speak of in prema? Because in bhava, one sees the Lord temporarily. In prema, one constantly sees the Lord. So therefore, that moksha is not even a drop of water in the desert anymore. It's like a molecule of water in the desert. Nothing. So the bliss that one experiences in relating with Krishna in rasa, in the bhakti rasamrita sindhu, is so great that nothing else is, has any significance at all in that point. So that's the outstanding quality of this ananda. No, nothing can get in. it's a solidified bliss. And then we have Krishna Akarshani, which means attracts even Krishna or Vishnu also, because we have praying for Vishnu. In this stage of prema, the Lord Himself surrenders to the devotee. And we see many examples like Krishna driving the chariot of Arjuna as a menial servant. In the story of Ambarish, Durvasa goes to the spiritual world and asks, protection from the Sudarshan Chakra. And Vishnu says, well, I can do nothing. My devotee is, that's my devotee. If my devotee wants, then says, okay, then Sudarshan will not burn you. But I can do nothing, not to my devotee. So he's given the Sudarshan Chakra to his devotee. He gives the power to the devotee. Gives everything to the devotee, gives the devotee the right to decide what if that person should get punished or not. So in this stage, the Supreme Lord does everything for the devotee. He also vows, I will, Namya Bhakta Pranasyati, my devotee is never vanquished. So he'll inevitably protect the devotee in all cases and do everything for the devotee. And to do that, he may put himself in a lower position. In the case that the ultimate case is the case of Radha, she's the ultimate devotee, supreme devotee, and therefore Krishna simply supremely surrenders unto her. And he becomes a servant of Radharani, serving her feet in complete surrender. So this manifests in prema, where God becomes subject to the devotee. And it looks as if God has lost his power, because the devotee is attracting God. Krishna means all attractive. But God becomes attracted to the devotee. In other words, we become attracted to God with complete attraction, and God becomes completely attracted to us in this stage. So it looks as if he's lost his independence. And that is true. Krishna gives up his independence for the devotee. He becomes dependent on the devotee, but on nobody else. So this is not manifest in any other process. And Krishna is not dependent on karmis, jnanis, yogis, people who have sankhya philosophy or anything. He'll never be dependent on them. But he becomes dependent on the devotee. So this is the supreme quality of bhakti. Most remarkable quality. Most remarkable quality of the Lord. Due to his loving nature. So these are the six outstanding qualities. And in prema, all the other four, the previous four also manifest, as well as the last two, the previous four also manifest. In other words, there's complete annihilation of klesha, there's complete manifestation of good qualities, compassion for living entities, that sukha turns into ananda. Moksha is disregarded, and it's very, 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 very rare. Nobody can attain that position. Okay. So Rupa Goswami concludes this chapter, that is Samanya Bhakti, or a general presentation of bhakti, by saying that to understand bhakti, what he's mentioned in this chapter and in what will be mentioned in all the successive chapters, it cannot be understood by logic or by tarka, by argumentation, only by ruchi, some genuine faith and devotional attitude. That by that you can understand what it means. Otherwise, useless. You cannot understand. Okay. Any questions? Let's just do a little exercise here. We went over the qualities of bhakti. And in the first one, Klesha Agni, can anyone give an example, quoting a verse from Bhagavatam, to show how the effect of avidya. Avidya is removed. Anyone can quote a verse? I can think of several. Ignorance. How is ignorance removed? Bhagavad Gita? Huh? No, a verse from Bhagavad Gita, I'm saying. Verse from Bhagavad Gita? Yeah. 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 Last of the chapter, Slokhi. Yeah. Yeah. So, devotional service to Krishna removes ignorance. What about Tatvija? Anyone have a sloka for that? From Bhagavad Gita? Anyone think of anything? Oh, but that's the other one. We're getting that's not Pop Vija, that's Papa. I was gonna ask that one next. What about the Pop Vija? Anyone have a verse for that? In other words, Kama. How he rules Kama, a desire. Anyone think of it? No? No. Oh, getting a higher case. Yeah, and then we can give up the lower case. Yeah, I guess so. That'd cover it. And of course, Papa, then we have the verse you mentioned and a very famous verse about Krishna removing Papa. The most famous verse. Sarva Dharma Parajasha. Aham Swam Sarva Papa Bhyo Moksha Syami Masu Chaha. I remove all sins. So when he says that, what does he mean? Actually, that can refer to sinful desires also. Because if you don't have any sinful desires, then you won't commit sins. But it also refers to the reactions. I remove all suffering. And also, because suffering is a result of the papa. So that means prabda, aparabda, all this is removed by Krishna when you surrender to him. Okay. Many, many verses, of course. Let's see, anything else? Okay. What about... let's see, anything else? Oh, that's okay. Okay, I think we better stop here. It's our break time now. 10 to 2. So, or is it 12 or 11 or 10 to 11? 11? 11. Okay. Maybe we can do a little bit more then. Okay. So that ends the first wave. So second wave is sadhana bhakti. This is a very long wave. A big wave. Because it has two parts to it. And the sadhana part is, the vaidhi part is quite long. There's two parts, that is vaidhi, sadhana, and raganuga, sadhana. These two parts. So Rupa Goswami begins by giving a definition of sadhana bhakti. Already he's given one definition of uttama bhakti. So uttama bhakti is the main definition. Within that, we're going to get a definition for sadhana bhakti, for bhav bhakti and prem bhakti. But they all fall within the main definition. They're sub-definitions of the main definition. Anya abhilash dashanya. So within that, we get sadhana bhakti definition, bhav bhakti definition, and prem bhakti definition. In other words, we have the big definition. Within there, we'll get different areas that these different types of bhakti cover. Or different types of people or different stages. And within sadhana bhakti, then we're going to get a more definition. That is, definition of vaidhi bhakti and definition of raganuga. So these will fall within the sadhana definition. And the sadhana will fall within the general definition. So this is the basic format that Rupa Goswami has followed. Giving definitions and within the big definition and limiting it a little bit more. So the definition of sadhana bhakti is given here. This is also quoted in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Kriti sadhya bhavet sadhya bhavasa sadhana abhidha nitya siddhasya bhavasya prakritam shri sadhyata. Activities which lead to bhava or spiritual love for Krishna are called sadhana bhakti. In other words, the very definition of sadhana is those activities which lead from the initial shraddha stage to bhava. Everything in between there is called sadhana. So it could be vaidhi or it could be raganuga. Either way. Because they both lead to bhava. The eternal love from the spiritual world appears in the heart of the devotee, is not created or temporary. That's the second line. It's just as a bhavasya. Prakatyam shriti sajata. So on the first line, that's the main definition. Kriti sadhya. Kriti here means senses and mind. So one performs activities using the senses and the mind, etc. In such a way that we come to the level of bhava. So we can say engagement of body, mind, words to come to the stage of bhava. And what is bhava? Bhava here is explained. Nitya siddhasya bhavasya prakritam shriti sajata. There is an appearance within the heart of bhava. It's not that it's created. When you say sajata, we may think it's created, but if bhava is created, it is temporary. If it's temporary, it's material. Spiritual things are eternal. So therefore, he says here, it appears in the heart. It's not manufactured from somewhere that suddenly we can produce it, out of two different elements or something. It is something eternal. So it simply appears, manifests within the heart of the jiva at that point. Okay, and it's called nitya siddhasya. Nitya. Sadhya, to be attained. We have what is called sadhana and sadhya. Sadhana means the practice. Sadhya means the goal. That's the general thing. Or to be attained. The goal or that which is to be attained.
Why does it say that if it's kriti sajya, why is it kriti doing the way, why is sajya there also?
Oh, okay. We can say the perfection of activities. to get a result from your activities is sajya bhava. Bhava comes to the level of bhava. The perfection of engagement of senses is to come to the level of bhava. And bhava means it's a manifestation within the heart, not of the physical heart, obviously, but in the jiva. A manifestation in the jiva of something which is eternal, nityasiddha. So something which is always there, but it's manifesting at a certain point in the jiva. There's an argument here, a little controversy, in some circles, but what is this nitya siddhasya? So some say nitya siddhasya means eternal associates in the spiritual world, which is nitya siddha. So their bhava, or a fragment of their bhava, enters into the jiva. Or we can say their inspiration, at least, enters into the jiva at this point. That's one interpretation. Other interpretation is simply what is in the jiva, which is also eternal, manifests at that point. Whether it's from the spiritual world or whether it's in us, it doesn't really matter because it's all spiritual. But there's a little controversy there about what nitya siddha means. Some say it means nitya siddha people in the spiritual world. Otherwise, you can say it's the eternal quality of the jiva, and it manifests at this point in time. So therefore, to come to this stage where we get a manifestation of bhava, or we can say that eternal love, the first point of that, that all the way up to there is called sadhana. Now this definition falls within the other definition, that is anyavilasa-dasanya. So engagement of the senses, which is favorable to Krishna and without any other desire. And that leads to all the way up to bhava. All those stages are called sadhana. Okay. I'll cover the other definition. Okay, so then I'll cover the other definition. That is, Vaidhi Bhakti is within this definition, all the way up to Bhava. So there's two types of that sadhana engagement. So the first is called Vaidhi Bhakti, Yatra Rag Anavaptatvat. As long as there is not an attaina of raga, that tendency does not come about, then one should follow the rules of Shastra. One should be under the control of the rules of Shastra. If one does not have that spontaneous attachment, and then one should follow the rules. That is called Vaidhi Bhakti. Vaidhi comes from Vidhi. Vidhi means rules. Sasanena Shastrasya. By the rule of Shastra, the control of Shastra. So in other words, when we do our devotional service, why do we do it? Because Shastra said so, Bhagavad Gita said so, Bhagavatam says I should chant, and now I chant. So this is Vaidhi Bhakti. The what is raga, we'll discuss that later in the next definition. And here's an example here. Just a quotation. Smartavyasa Dham Vishnur, vi smartavyo na jato chit, sarve vidi niseda sur etayor eva kinkaraha. That always remember Vishnu, never forget him. All vidis, and that is all injunctions and nishads or prohibitions, are the servants of these two rules. So this is Vaidhi. Rules are there, follow the rules. And all the rules are meant for remembering the Lord and not forgetting Him at any point. Okay. Question? No?
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, to get that raga, generally you need a guru. One cannot come to the stage of raga unless one has a guru who has raga, generally. That's how you get raga nuga, from a guru. Yeah. And of course he gives you inspiration in that direction also, at all times. It's not that we're completely independent at that stage, no. Still one has guru and association. Whatever applies to Vaidhi Bhakti in terms of Angas of Bhakti also applies to raga nuga. Actually, same Angas are there. So association, chanting, hearing, deity worship, they're all there also in Raghunath. So obviously one needs, you know, guidance there also. So it's not completely spontaneous. That is prema. Completely unpredictable. Independent of everyone. What is that? Yeah. We have to force ourselves to do something. Well, obviously, it's not completely forced, because by Shraddha, which is our own free will, we agree to do it, you know? We have a little faith, then by our will, we go to devotees and have association in here, and we get Shastra from them, and then we follow. So it's not completely forced, but at the same time, generally to do anything, we'll have to consult Shastra. Should I do this or not do this? Then I will, okay, Shastra says do it like this, I will do it like that. But we're initially willing, obviously, to do it. But nevertheless, there is a prominence of Shastric injunction. We guide our actions, what to do and not to do by that. In Raghunuga, that is much less apparent. So therefore, we may not follow what is said in Shastra. One will worship the deity, but it may not be according to the same rules of Shastra. Somebody forces us to do something, is that called Vaidhi Bhakti? Well, if it's for our own good, obviously, okay, you must follow the regulative principles. We don't follow the regulative principles, and then we follow because he's forcing us, and we can say it's part of Vaidhi Bhakti. But ultimately, it may not work because you can never force a jiva. You can do it artificially for some time. If there's no faith there to begin with, then that force will automatically become weakened eventually, and one will break the principles. If the faith is strong enough, and one's having a struggle, if the faith is strong enough, then one will continue to follow. It would depend on the situation, yeah? Because sometimes it may be good for us, but we don't think it is good for us due to our mind, you know. That's also discussed by, you know, Krishna Chakravarti, the neophyte devotee, you know, in the first stage, Anishita Bhakti. He has all, so many concoctions. So somebody say, well, this is all, you know, nonsense. But we will think it's not nonsense. And we say, I want to do something else. I want to go and be a Babaji in Vrindavan. And somebody says, no, you can't do that. And force us to sit in the temple. So good for us, but nevertheless, we may not think so. So therefore, just to follow your own free will is not necessarily good in all cases. In some cases, of course, it may be better. Because that other person also may not have proper judgment, and he may be forcing you to do something which is good for him, but not good for you. So this is, it goes like case by case, I think. Okay, we'll break here. Everyone filled out this attendance?
Thinking of the stages before Nishtha is being practicing Karma Yoga, is what the yoga is about Nishtha?
Well, we'll go according to our definition here, because Nishtha sadhana includes, you know, anarjana vritti, Nishtha. This is also a sadhana bhakti, and it's in within Uttama Bhakti. So therefore we can't say it's Karma Nishtha Bhakti or anything like that. It could be a borderline case, of course, if one is not really, you know, following this principle of Anya Abhilasha, then it would be mixed bhakti. But we're hoping that one gets sadhu sangha, gets knowledge, then one would be trying to follow that properly. And then we would call Uttama Bhakti, even though it's not pure, obviously.
I thought I had this idea that it creates another beach and another teaching.
Well, that's how it is, I think, in Dhanagar Swami's book. But I don't agree with that. Yeah. Obviously, you get caught up in the cycle of karma, you can never get out. Bhagavad Gita is simple, yeah. Well, in general, all these, and commentaries especially, will get very complicated sometimes. Like Vishnath's commentaries, long words, long sentences, everything. Yeah. That's true also. And sometimes they do the opposite, they're very brief, and you can't figure out what they're trying to say because they give you two words, and that's the commentary. Two words. It's related to, like sutra, yeah. Everybody understood, I guess. They're a little more intelligent than us. They could pick up, oh, he means this, or he means this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's generally what they do. They just say, according to, and he quotes the first two lines of a verse, and that's it. According to this, and according to this, and according to this, then this. He just quotes the first two, you know, words of a verse or something. He doesn't mention where it comes from. He expected you to know where it comes from. That's very common in the commentaries. And particularly because if they quote the whole verse even, it gets so voluminous. They said, yeah. And that's a problem when we get to English translation. We quote the whole verse, we quote the translation, when we quote a whole series, we get lost in our thought where we're, you know, the original idea was. But they say, so and so, this is iffy, therefore this. Therefore you can understand their logic and what they're trying to say to you here. This also, in this book, it becomes the same because there's so many quotations sometimes, particularly concerning liberation and why it's so insignificant. He gives, I think, 32 quotations, which last over like three chapters, five chapters of the Nectar of Devotion. And after that, you don't know where you are anymore, you know? Because he quoted so many verses, you tend to get lost. But if you look at the structure in the Sanskrit there, you'll see how it's quite obvious what's happening. Shall we start? So what is the qualification for sadhana bhakti? Vaidhi sadhana bhakti, that is. Vaidhi sadhana. So, there's a verse here. Yidrachaya matkata do jata sradas tu yat puman na nirvindo na atisakto bhakti yogasya siddhida. He who has developed faith in topics of Krishna, who is not too attached to matter and not too attached to impersonal liberation, is qualified. Nirvinda means detachment. He's not too detached. In other words, he's not inclined to impersonal liberation. It becomes a disqualification. He can have some detachment, but if he gets too much into detachment, then he becomes an impersonalist. So that's not good. So a little detachment is okay. And he shouldn't be too attached. That doesn't mean we have to have no attachment, but you know, we can't have too much attachment either. Too much attachment will make us fall into sinful activities, and we can't practice bhakti. So some attachment may be there, but it's okay. You start somewhere, at least. Not too attached to impersonal matter, liberation, not too attached to material enjoyment. Plus, one has to have shraddha, jata shraddha. That sincerity in there. And where is that shraddha directed? Towards topics of Krishna, towards shastra. Faith in Vaidhi Bhakti means faith in Shastra. We develop faith in Shastra. We read, and we say, oh, we'll accept. We don't argue about it. We don't protest. We say, okay, fine, we'll accept. So our faith is residing there first. We can't see Krishna directly, but at least the Shastra is there. We accept that. And whatever Shastra says, we'll accept. So the description of Krishna, will accept that description of Krishna on faith. So that's the definition, the qualification. So Rupa Goswami divides the qualification into three types, three levels of qualification in Vaidhi, Sadhana, Bhakti. That is Uttama, Madhyama, and Kanishta. Now there's going to be a confusion here because Uttama sometimes refers to a Mahabhagavata who's on the level of Prema. And that's how we use it in ISKCON usually. Uttamadhikari, he's, you know, Prem Bhakta, and Madhyamadhikari is below that, and Kanishka is really, you know, unadvanced. But here, Uttamadhikari refers to a person who is still in Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, which means he's not Abhava even, much less Prema. He's in Sadhana Bhakti, and he's called Uttamadhikari. So there's a little bit of a confusion sometimes when we talk about Uttamadhikari. It may mean this or maybe that other definition. So we have to be careful.
Does Uttam mean best in the group, right?
Yeah. So obviously it's a relative term. We get Uttam in reference to the whole of Bhakti, in which case we get a Mahabhagavata, the pure devotee on the level of Prema. Or we can have an Uttama within Vaidhi Bhakti, which is Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. Yeah. Also. So it's a relative term. So here he's using it in reference to Vaidhi Bhakti. Kanishka level of well, it's within the Vaidhi Bhakti level, Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, which is in Sadhana Bhakti. What do you want to call it? Kanishka or not? Sadhana Bhakti is Kanishka or not? I don't know if you want to say that. That wouldn't make sense, would it? Madhyam generally is the preacher, and even the Bhava Bhakta is not the preacher. It's the person in the Sadhana Bhakti who's doing the preaching. So Madhyam usually would refer to someone in Nishta, I would think, or somewhere in the later parts of Anarshana Vritti, and Nishta would be the Madhyama. And the Kanishka would be Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Vajna Kriya, Anarshana Vritti up in there. Though technically even we could even put the I guess so. You can put it like that, yeah. But here the Kanishka may not even be on he's the very beginning here in this definition. Let's go over them first. We'll start at the bottom of the Kanishka. So the Kanishka, Yobhavet Komala Shraddha Sa Kanishka Nigadyate, he is called Kanishka, or junior, who has Komala Shraddha. Komala means tender faith, immature faith, weak faith. The Acharyas explain that this means that if someone argues with him, he will change his mind. he'll get convinced by other people of their siddhanta, and he may go away. But generally he'll come back again, because he does have faith of some sort. So he may go away, but then he'll come back later. That's Komala Shraddha. If he doesn't come back at all, he's even less than Kanishka. So that means he does not have proper knowledge of Shastra. The faith is not fixed in the Shastra proper. He has not proper knowledge, so therefore when other people speak, he gets confused. There's Shraddha there, but he gets very confused, bewildered by the arguments given, then he goes away and later comes back. So his faith is weak, and his knowledge of Shastra is very, very little. So generally there's a relationship here between the Shraddha and the knowledge of Shastra. Little knowledge, weak faith. More knowledge, stronger faith. Deep knowledge, very deep faith. And that's the second category is Madhyama. Yashastra adishu anipuna shraddhavan satu madhyamaha. One is a Madhyama who is very faithful, shraddhavan, his faith is quite strong, but he's not skillful in Shastra. So he has some knowledge of Shastra, therefore he is stronger. So that if people do argue with him, he does not go away. But he may get defeated. He cannot argue back, he cannot do anything to defend himself, but he will not leave. He will not go away. So he's shraddhavan. But his Shastra knowledge is insufficient to defeat others. It's strong enough to keep him faithful. It is weak so that he cannot defeat others and counter their arguments. So that is Madhyama. So Uttama, Shastra Yukta Cha Nipuna. That means skillful. The previous one is anipuna in shastra. Here, shastra, yuktao, in shastra and in yukti, logic. He is skillful, expert. Sarvata, in all cases, dridha nishaya, in all cases, very, very convinced and fixed up. Prauda sraddha, deep sraddha. Prauda sraddha adhikari, yatsa bhakta uttama mata. He is called the uttam bhakta, who has very deep faith, very strong convictions in all cases, and very skillful in logic and shastra. So this person, when he meets an opponent, of course he will not lose his faith, but more than that, because of his expert arguments, using shastra and logic, he's able to defeat the other person and also convince the other person. His faith is very strong, and his knowledge and his use of logic is very good. So therefore, he can not only defeat the person, he can also convince the other person. That is uttama. So all of these cases are related to faith and knowledge of shastra. And therefore, they're included in sadhana bhakti. And vaidhi. Vaidhi sadhana bhakti. Because they're all related to shastra also. Vaidhi means following shastra. Not by study. Well, as I said, these things are secondary to the bhakti. Now, of course, here there's shastra, yuktao, logic, and shastra. So sometimes people say, well, how is it possible? Because previously said that Tarka cannot get to Krishna also. Argumentation. You cannot understand bhakti. So here it is explained that yukti here means that intelligence or logic which is not contradictory and in subservience to the shastra conclusions. Generally, we do need intelligence to read shastra. We have to connect the sentences together. We have to connect the paragraphs together. We have to make sense of the whole work. We have to solve the contradictions. Well, like Krishna says in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, worship the demigods, and you can be happy. And chapter 9, he says, don't worship demigods. It's foolish. How do you reconcile the statements? We have to use our intelligence. If you cannot explain that, people will lose faith in the Bhagavad Gita also. So we have to be intelligent enough to explain it. Justify why Krishna says like this here and says like this here. So we have to use logic. By doing that properly, consistently, then we can give other people faith also. We can also get faith in ourselves, and that Krishna's not foolish in making opposite statements, meaningless statements. Plus, we get faith ourselves, and we can give faith to others. So intelligence can be used, but always, you know, in relation to shastra, and not, you know, going off independently. Yeah. Oh, that's also in Angas of Bhakti. That's one of the do not too many shastras, learning too many shastras for itself is not useful. It's just a careful balance we have to follow. Ultimately depending on our motivation. Why we want to learn the shastra, for what purpose. If we wanted to only to defeat people, only to get position, only for profit or some other reason, then maya. Not favorable for devotional development. If it's in pursuance of developing our own faith and helping others develop faith, then good. So we have these classifications. Any questions? Now in the Bhagavatam, there is another, this is a classification. In Vaidhi Bhakti according to faith, based on Shraddha. In the Bhagavatam there is another definition. In that definition we have the Kanishta as having faith in the Supreme Lord, but not in anything else, not in devotees or anything. And the Madhyama associates and has respect for the devotees, accepts the Lord, avoids the demons, and is merciful to the innocent people. People that are not aparadis, but are not devotees. He preaches to them. And the Uttamadhikari sees everything as Krishna. Everything is Krishna's mercy. So that's the Bhagavat definition. Bhagavatam. So obviously it's a little different from this. The Uttamadhikari and the Madhyam don't match this. So we can say that at least the Madhyama and the Uttama here would be within the Madhyam category there. Maybe even part of the Kanishna also, perhaps, that would fit within the Madhyamadhikari definition in the Bhagavatam. Yeah, that's the definition of three stages mentioned there also. Huh? That is the when the people from Kuli and Gram came to Puri, they asked Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava? Then he says, anyone who chants Hare Krishna once is a Vaishnava. And then they got a little confused by that, but they didn't say anything. And they went back to Bengal next year. They came back again and they asked Lord Chaitanya, who is a Vaishnava? And he says, anyone who chants holy name constantly is a Vaishnava. And then they got a little confused again because it contradicted what he said the first year. They didn't say anything. They went back to Bengal again. Next year they came again and said, who is a Vaishnava? And he said, and he is a Vaishnava who, upon seeing, makes you chant Hare Krishna. So he gave three levels there also, in terms of the name. This is in terms of stage. That, of course, again, is going all the way. Well, it maybe corresponds to this also a little bit. Once chanting, continually chanting, obviously he's got more faith, more taste, and one who is able to make other people chant purely from his own chanting. In other words, he's a good preacher, and he can convince other people also. So that kind of corresponds to this Uttama here. That's in terms of chanting, holy name. But in the Bhagavatam definition, the Uttama basically does not preach. It is the Madhyamadhikari who is merciful to the innocent people, avoids the demons, etc. And the Uttama makes no distinction between demon and devotee and doesn't really preach that much. So it's a little bit different, that definition. So in other words, that Uttama is on the level of bhava and prema. And that Madhyama is probably the from maybe Shraddha to, you know, Asakti. Okay. Any question? No further. Okay. So Rupa Goswami mentions that some things are not qualifications for practicing bhakti, and rather they're disqualification, that is, bhukti, material assets, etc. These are not qualifications for bhakti. In other words, you don't have to have previously experienced all types of pleasure in order to begin the practice of bhakti. This is the assumption of some people in spiritual practice, that let us experience all pleasures, and once we've exhausted that, then we can go on with our spiritual practice. And we don't say that. So it's not necessary one has to have experienced all pleasures or whatever. No, that's not a consideration. And mukti also, to aspire for mukti, detachment. These are not qualifications for bhakti. That's why I said, you know, the qualification was not too detached. One doesn't have to be completely renounced. One doesn't have to be a sannyasi. One doesn't have to be a jnani. In the Vedanta Sutras, the first sutras, what? Vedanta Sutras, Atato Brahma Jigasa. Now then, inquire about Brahman. So then many of the commentators, they will say, okay, now means this. Once you've done this, 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 and this. So Shankara says, you can inquire about Brahman once you've passed through and experienced Karmakanda in full. And then you've reached the stage of detachment. And when you're detached, then you can begin the inquiry about Brahman and practice of jnana. So you qualified by having done Karmakanda, passed through it, gone from tama all the way up to sattva, and then become detached. And then you can practice the inquiry of Brahman. So those are qualifications. So for Vaidya-sadhana-bhakti, no. Mukti, not a qualification. Detachment, not a qualification. Mukti, not a qualification. Those are not considerations at all. All good qualities. In the Subhadah, you mean? In Subhadah? Would he have to? It doesn't say that he's developed all good qualities. It's just in terms of faith here. Huh? We can assume, of course, that the Uttam Adhikari in Sadhana Bhakti would be in upper stages. Maybe he's at Nishtar, Ruchi, or Sakti, somewhere up there. Huh? And correspondingly, then one would assume that he would have developed Subhadah of all sorts, compassion for living entities, good qualities, contentment, satisfaction. All these things would also have developed by that stage. Wouldn't mean all good qualities, because all good qualities aren't going to develop fully until bhava and prema. Huh? Because it's still a purification stage. So it's not that every single good quality is going to develop in him. Huh? There are still faults in the jiva, even in bhava. Huh? But we can say that something is developing. You know, it's, okay, so bhukti and mukti are not qualifications. Varnashram is not a qualification, huh? One doesn't have to be a brahmana to practice. Huh? In some practices, definitely you have to be high quality. In other words, you have to reach sattva. Even yoga, you have to be sattvic to practice. And therefore, they have the preliminaries of yama and niyama to make you sattvic. You follow all these practices, then you can practice yoga and do the asanas and pranayama, etc. Similarly, jnana, you have to go up to karmakanda, discipline yourself, get up to sattva gun, then you can practice. Yeah? So you have to be basically brahminical to be a jnani. Yeah? For bhakti, no, doesn't matter. Not even less than sudra can begin the practice of vaidya bhakti. And that's, of course, we see anyone can take the chanting of the holy name. And they're not in the varnashram. It could be chandala. Even a chandala chants once, then he surpasses the brahmana. So, therefore, varnashram is not a consideration at all, not a qualification. Yeah. Well, obviously, the initial, we can start anywhere, but in order to advance, we have to become purified. Okay? Because the influence of tama and rajas are not favorable for devotional development. Generally, sattva is a more favorable mode. It's also material, so ultimately that's not our goal. So we don't say it's a qualification to begin bhakti to be sattvic. But in the process of bhakti, when we do anarjana vritti, obviously we have to get rid of tamas and rajas and even sattva eventually. So we'll pass through sattva in the purification process. And it's definitely more favorable than the lower modes of nature. Because if you're in tamas, then you don't want to do anything. It's very difficult to do bhakti if you're continually in tamas. But it doesn't disqualify a person. Therefore, Krishna says, Striyo Vaishya Sudras Tepi Yandi Parangadim. Even a woman Vaishya and Sudras can go to the Supreme. And Murgari the Hunter was less than a Sudra. He wasn't even a Sudra. But he was engaged in devotional service. And by the mercy of Narada, and of course his own free will, then he advanced very quickly. So it's not an initial qualification, but definitely we have to rise above the gunas. Okay. So that Rupa Goswami also mentioned the different types of liberation. And even these, desire for these types of liberation, the five types of liberation, these are also not qualifications that are also rejected by the devotees of the Lord. Though in general, these things are encouraged within, let's say, Varnashram system. Mukti or Sayuja is encouraged as superior to everything else. But even this is rejected by Bhakti. So all the different types of liberation are not considered good aspirations for one in devotional service. In relation to this, Rupa Goswami mentions about that Govinda is the best. of all the forms. And he says, essentially, Krishna and Vishnu are non-different, Siddhantatas, which means they're both God. They're not Jiva, and they're no way inferior as classified as God. They're the same. So then what is the difference? The difference is in terms of rasa. We could say the manifestation of rasa is complete in Krishna. He will manifest completely all of the five primary rasas and seven secondary rasas. As we saw, Akila Rasamrita Murti. It's manifest completely in Krishna. It is also in all forms, we can say, but not manifest. Because God is God, so everything should be in God. So all things are there in God, but it's not manifest in the form or in the activities of the other forms, only in Krishna. So the form of Krishna is very suitable to manifest certain qualities and certain activities, which will produce all of these rasas in full. That is the difference between Vishnu and Krishna in terms of rasa. I believe Vishnu Chakravarti says this. What it ultimately means is that Krishna has the Rasa-lila. Because in rasa, the Rasa-lila is the ultimate manifestation of all rasas. And the most spectacular display of rasa. So if one is qualified for bhakti, then he is not obliged to follow things which are less. If we're on one level, then we should follow those rules, not the lower rules. If someone's qualified lower, let him follow those rules. If one is qualified for a higher level, let him follow those rules. If we're qualified for bhakti, that means we do not have to follow the rules of Varnashram. They're lower rules. We follow bhakti. And in bhakti, we cannot follow high rules also if we're not qualified for them. So if we're not qualified for bhava or raganuga, we cannot do that. We have to do vaidhi bhakti. But we should also not go down and do the lower rules, that is, varnashrama things also. Then, of course, there's an objection there. Therefore, if we give up all rules of varnashrama, then it'll be lawless. That is true. So therefore, this is qualified, the statement is qualified. Those things in the Varnashram which are favorable for our devotional development, those we can follow. If they're contradictory, definitely we won't do. And we're not obliged to do them at all. An example is Shraddha rites. Generally, they're contradictory because they involve worship of devatas and pitras. And there's many statements in the Shastra which will say for the Vaishnava, we should not worship pitras and devatas. Therefore, do those rites is rejected. We're not obliged to follow them. And if we don't follow them, it's not sinful. In Varnashrama, it says, if you don't do the pitra rites, then you're a sinner. But for a devotee, they're not a sinner. Because they're on the higher level. We can, of course, go in between there, because sometimes it looks very peculiar if we neglect our parents or everybody else, they'll say, you are so callous and indifferent to everybody, and they'll criticize you for that. So the compromise can be made. You could do the Shraddha rites, but you don't have any devatas or pitras in it. So out of formality's sake and to not disturb society, we can participate in such things, but we don't involve ourselves in the worship of devatas or pitras. That much we can follow. However, that we're not obliged to follow, and if it becomes too time consuming and too distracting, then we can also reject it again. So that applies to all the different rules. There's another statement in Bhagavatam, that is that to the degree that you still have attachment to material energy, to that degree you also have to follow Varnashram. Even in devotional service. So in other words, the more attachment you have, the more rules you have to follow. But even then, they should not be contradictory to bhakti. They should not be unfavorable. Eh? They should not cover up bhakti, jnana, karma, jidavartam. So that means, therefore, if one is a grihastha, then one has obligated to follow quite a lot of the rules. one has attachments, and then one has to follow all the rules for married life, but make them non-contradictory to bhakti, that's all. Okay? So in that way, we do sometimes follow the rules of varnashram. If one is completely free, paramahamsa, devotee, then he's not obliged to anything. No rules of varnashram apply. But everybody along the way, obviously, would have to follow something. Within bhakti itself, we can also incorporate some rules of varnashram. Though we don't label varnashram as such. It's, let's say, varnashram culture has entered into the standard conduct of the Vaishnava also. In other words, rules of cleanliness are taken from varnashram. We take a bath every day, you know, rules of what is pure and impure is taken from varnashram. You know, bones, stool, blood is impure. It's from varnashram. Huh? Taking a bath, wearing clean clothes. This is all varnashramic. So we also follow. And it's part of our vidhi also. Huh? So some of the vidhis of varnashram, the Vaishnava has also adopted in relation to body, mind, etc. So society, some scarves are taken from varnashram. Then the grass is obliged to follow samskaras for children, raising children, etc. It's all varnashram. But we make them also non-contradictory to devotional service. And we take out the deva to worship and pitra worship. Yeah, it's rather, I don't know myself. But Bhaktivinoda says Daiva Varnashram would mean that it is a Varnashram system which does not contradict the tenets of bhakti. So in other words, we can say it is at least free from, you know, devata worship and personalism, etc. And it's a social system which allows people to get their, you know, bodily needs fulfilled, social needs fulfilled, but at the same time, it's not unfavorable for bhakti, doesn't contradict it, and Tenari's pointing towards Vishnu, has Vishnu in the center, even though maybe indirect for people in those lower modes. So it's most, we can say, all societies have some sort of varnashram, maybe distorted, but some form of varnashram, but generally, it is without God, so it's asuric. Then we can put God in it, but then it's still haphazard. You know, God for some people means deva doesn't everything. So for Bhaktivinoda, it means we have a very clear conception who is God and who is not God, and that becomes the main center.
So that's an analogy that Ivanashram is given by who?
Well, I think Bhaktivinoda uses it.
And means aspects of Ivanashram that
induces the Bhaktivinoda. Yeah. And it looks as if he's applying it to the whole society. He talks about the evolution of societies from the primitive, let's say, no rules and regulation and atheistic. And then we get to the role where we have rules and regulations, but still nothing, no idea of God. Then we have the idea of rules and regulations plus God. That's a higher level. And then we advance to bhakti and all that from that. So that this is a real civilization where we get rules and regulations of our ashram with God. Then it is real civilization. He also analyzes these varnashram rules that we apply in bhakti by saying that they are gona vidhi, which means secondary devotional rules. And the mukya vidhi are, which we will, the angas of bhakti we follow, such as hearing, chanting, remembering. That is mukya vidhi, engagement in devotional service. The gona vidhi are the rules adapted from varnashram system which are necessary for us to follow in relation to our body and our mind and society, etc. That is bathing, social interactions, rules for interactions between different people, men and women, husband and wife, children and parents, all these things, taken from the varnashram system. But applicable also to devotees and their, you know, living in families and society. Okay, so that's called gona vidhi, or secondary rules of bhakti. Yeah. It may be unfavorable for our situation, so we cannot develop practice the primary ones. In other words, if we don't have good health, then it's very difficult to chant. So therefore we should have good health, therefore we should be clean. But being clean does not produce bhakti. We have very clean atheists also. The atheists will take a bath also every day. We have atheist vegetarians. So vegetarianism does not create bhakti. It may create sattva, it does not create bhakti. But it's also favorable to be vegetarian. So they're favorable, they don't create bhakti. So all these secondary rules, let's say, don't create bhakti, but they're favorable for us, our situation. They create a sattvic environment for us, basically. He's done a very nice analysis of this in the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita. He goes through all the rules, actually. Social rules and mental rules, physical rules, everything. So back to the subject, one should practice what one is qualified for. Follow the rules of what one is qualified for. That is a good quality, and to do the opposite, that's a bad quality. That's his verse here. Svesve adhikare ya nishta saguna parikirtata. One is glorified who is steady in following his qualification, practicing according to his qualification. Which Krishna also says in Bhagavad Gita, hey, don't go beyond your, gunas. Don't do something you're unqualified for. And there's other verses here. Even if you give up, if you surrender to the Lord's lotus feet, if you give up your regular svadharma, that is Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, etc., duties, and even if you do not perfect bhakti, it is not a fault. But if you follow all the rules of Varnashram, but you don't worship the Lord, you lost everything. So one should not be censured or criticized for not following all the rules of Varnashram system if one has become a devotee. He's not obliged to follow. The condition is that according to one's attachment, one should follow something, but make it non-contradictory to bhakti. According to qualification. Well, of course, we've had here different in Vaidhi Bhakti, we've had the Uttama, Madhyama, and Kanishta. And then in we have within Sadhana, we have Raghunuga and Vaidhi Bhakti. So if we don't have developed that Raga, if we haven't got as far as Raga, then to practice Raghunuga would be beyond our qualification. So the definition of sadhana was, as long as one does not have that raga, one should follow the rules of shastra. So if one goes beyond that and still practices raga, then it's considered bad. That's what it means. Don't go beyond or don't go below. Both are false. To do less is to be lazy. We're qualified for Uttama Vaidhi Bhakti, but we do Kanishta. We don't apply our intelligence at all. Even though we're qualified to use our intelligence to, use Shastra Prabhu, we're too lazy to do it, then that's considered a fault. On the other hand, to pretend that we know everything when we don't, that's going beyond our qualification. So that's also bad. So we have to find the exact thing and follow accordingly, proper level. To do otherwise creates disturbance. Bhaktivinoda says it is like climbing up stairs. So when you climb up the stairs, you put your foot on the other stair, and then you put your gradually take your other foot up and you stick it on the next stair. After this foot is steady, if foot is in the air, you don't put your other foot up. You put your foot on the next step first. You get it steady there, then you pull the other foot up. And then when this foot is steady, then you put this foot up again and you make it steady. So gradually you're supposed to go upwards, not downwards. So we're not trying to stay at the same level all the time. Okay, I'm qualified with this level. I'll stay there forever. That's also not proper. I want you to aspire for the higher level and definitely make attempts to go up there. When we want to study in that level, then we'll drop from the lower level and not follow those rules and regulations. Follow the higher rules. One's fun to study in that level. So you gradually attain steadiness in the next level. Then you pull yourself up and not follow the lower level anymore. So we shouldn't stay in one place. We shouldn't go down. We should try to go up. We shouldn't suddenly go up also. Yeah. That's why the goal is necessary. Prayojana is necessary. Okay. Fine. Okay. We'll get another 15 minutes here. Questions? You're not?
Like you said that you're
climbing
the stairs and
then
you're already in one level and then you shouldn't use the rules of the
previous. Yeah. Like
previous
or whatever. Lower level. Lower level. Well, we do have, in other words, let's say, if one is in the sadhana level of uttama, vaidhi bhakti, then one should not be lazy and simply go down to the next level, the madhyam or the uttama, finisher level, and follow a lesser level, and be lazy, and not apply one's intelligence to shastra, etc. or forget everything one has learned, and come to a lower level. That, in other words, one would give up preaching and not do anything, yeah? If one has reached that level, one should try to maintain that level and go higher. And not stay at the same level also. Aspire for higher and not be lazy and be lower. In terms of bhakti and other things, if one has reached the level of bhakti, one should not fall back and just go back into karma again. And give up bhakti and go to karma. That's also not good. Once one has understood what bhakti is and has some faith, one should not simply go back into karma again. That's following a lower level. Okay, I think we'll break here, and then we'll just do all the angas next. Okay, let's go on with angas. This is the last major section of this section on Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. An anga literally means a limb, like a finger or an arm or a nose. These are limbs of the body. So, Rupa Goswami has used anga, this word, to describe the different types of bhakti. In other words, it's not one limb. There's many, many types of bhakti you could do, just like we have many limbs in the body, and it all composes the body. So many, many types of bhakti which compose the total of bhakti. All of which may be practiced, or many of which can be practiced, some of which are prominent, more important and very powerful. And some are, can also lead to Krishna directly, but may not be practiced by most people. So it's given a whole variety, including engagement for all the senses. And that is engagement for the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the hands, the feet, etc. And he's classified them like that. Before that, he also gives some preliminary angas, 20 preliminary angas of bhakti, which are called the door to bhakti. Which means that these have to be practiced or observed before we can do the other angas. He lists 64 angas and he gives 20 preliminary angas. So that means before we do the other 44, we should follow the first 20. They are the door to bhakti. Of those, 10 are positive, what you should do, and 10 are negative, what you shouldn't do. Don't do this, don't do that. Nishad. In the previous section we had, vidi nisheda yor, positive and negative, prohibitions and rules. So the first 10 are the rules, the second 10 are prohibitions. And without these, then we can't enter into bhakti. Rupa Goswami also says that the first 3 are the most important of all. So we'll study the first 10 and the second 10. there is a relationship. Generally, it's not pointed out like that, but there is a relationship. We can see there is a relationship between the first 10 and the second 10, many of the elements there. One is the positive, one is the negative. Huh? So we can more easily remember them in that way. The first one is Guru Parasraya, to take shelter of the lotus feet of the Guru. That's number one. Second one is Shiksha Dikshadi Grahanam, to accept teachings, initiation, etc. The third one is to serve the Guru with great devotion. So these three, he says, are the most important. So in other words, he's putting Guru and devotee as number one influence on our bhakti and most important influence on the practice of our bhakti. For hearing, chanting, remembering, etc. So these three, he says, are very, very important. He doesn't elaborate here too much. He just, for all of these, he gives the 64 angas, he lists them, and then he gives quotations for each one from Shastra, from Bhagavatam and Padma Purana, Skanda Purana, for each of the angas. An example of smelling flowers. He gave an example from Shastra. Or surrender to the Guru. He'll give a Bhagavatam verse. This verse is given here. Tasmad Guru Prapadyate. For that one, surrender to Guru. So for each one, he does quote one verse or many verses for each particular item. But he doesn't explain them in detail. Just because these are the items and these are the proofs that they exist as angas of bhakti. Well, obviously the first 20 cannot be, the first 20 are important because unless you do those, you can't do the other 64. And I don't remember, but first three are probably of the first 20. Okay? So in other words, they are the entrance to the entrance. The interesting, of course, is he's separated them into three different angas. That is surrender, Shiksha Diksha, and service to Guru. So not only Guru is important, but also these three elements. That is the surrender, taking Shiksha and Diksha, and then service. Can anyone remember a verse in Bhagavad Gita about this? So pranipat means pat of course means to fall, like patita, very fallen. So nipat of course means to fall down also, and pra means to fall down extremely, to fall down completely. So pranipat, surrender. So Guru Parasraya, we can say, is a similar thing, to surrender oneself, take shelter and surrender in humility. And then we have Pariprashna, which means to literally to ask around. Pari means around, like perimeter. Pariprashna, to ask around. So ask everything about devotional things. So that's, of course, ask and get answers. That is Shiksha. To take instructions, get instructions, ask questions and get answers. Diksha, to get mantra. And Sela. Means service. So that's the third element. To serve the Guru with great devotion. So that's in Bhagavad Gita, it's also here. All important, because the function of Guru, of course, is to give us knowledge and inspiration, bhakti shakti, and that will not be transmitted unless one is devoid of pride and one is humble, and then one can get. One can't get knowledge with pride, nor can one get bhakti with pride. So therefore we also have another verse to tell us about humility. Anyone know a verse? Shunadapi Sanishina Torapi Sanishina. Lord Chaitanya says that this is the verse that he has to keep around his neck. And Guru told him to always remember this verse. So very also important for development of devotional service. So that applies not only to Krishna, but in relation to all devotees, in relation to all living entities, and also in relation to Guru. So we have to have a very submissive attitude to get knowledge or to get mercy. Otherwise it doesn't go, it doesn't come. It's like water. Water will flow down. Flows down. Won't flow up. So knowledge will also go down. If we're humble, then we get the knowledge. We're up here, then we don't get it. So therefore we have to be humble and surrender ourselves, surrender our ego. Then we have to be inquisitive and accept the knowledge. Not challenge the knowledge, but accept it nicely. So the guru is functioning to give. He gives knowledge, shiksha. He gives diksha, mantra. And says adi, etc. So of course he can give all sorts of guidance, etc. also. Inspiration. So we surrender to guru, and guru has a function. He also does something. He gives. So he gives shiksha, diksha, adi. And we have to accept it. Then seva. We also have to repay. We become rini or debtors if we take knowledge without doing anything in return. So therefore we also have to serve. Another aspect of the meaning of service, of course, is that we have the instructions given, but we also have to practice the instructions. What is the use of getting the instructions and the knowledge without implementing? So we also have to implement. So, for instance, in Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse. Which was inspiring to Prabhupada, about one-pointed intelligence or determination to serve Krishna. And then Vishwanath gives his purport there and says that actually we have to take the order of the guru like a life-sustaining medicine, which if we don't take, we die. So in other words, it's that the order of guru is our life and soul, and if we don't do it, then we die, spiritually speaking. Yeah? Like a medicine for diabetes. You don't take it, then your diabetes gets very extreme and you die. So like that, the order of guru is like that, something you have to keep taking to maintain your spiritual life. Well, what is the order? And so the order is that we should surrender to the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. That's the order. Ultimate order. We may have other orders, but ultimately the whole mission of the guru is to lead one to the surrender of Radha and Krishna. That's the ultimate order. And every other order should be in obedience to that. And so that's the order we have to follow. So if that's the instruction, then we should serve that instruction. We should try to do that, execute bhakti properly. So the teachings are given, we have to execute it properly. This is another way of saying service also. So what this implies, when this, Rupa Goswami says these are the three most important, one is that, of course, the next one after that, number four, is that one should follow according to Shastra. So therefore, we have Shastra and we have Guru. And the Shastra also has to be according to Sadhu. Sadhu Vartma. One has to follow after the Sadhus. One has to follow Shastra. So therefore, we take the Shastra, we take the previous Acharyas, and we take the Guru who comes from the Acharyas, the Parampara system. And this is a system of getting the instructions by which we can practice bhakti. And if we don't do that, we don't even get into the door of bhakti. So very, very necessary. Why is it necessary? Why can't we just take the Shastra? Or why can't we just take the Sadhu and the Shastra? And not the Guru? He says it's like this. Guru Padasraya, he says. He doesn't say Sadhu Padasraya. And that would be Rupa Goswami or anybody else previous. He says Guru Padasraya. And take the Guru. So in other words, what he is saying is that the teachings have to come through a guru. The Acharyas teachings, the sadhu's teachings, the shastras have to come to the guru. And to get that knowledge, one has to be humble in front of the guru. One has to be qualified by inquisitiveness and desire for it. And then one can get the knowledge. Otherwise, it doesn't come. And then service. One has to serve also. Practically serve it. So this is the process of getting the knowledge. That means sambandha jnana, abhijaya, prayojana. All this comes through these first three steps. Okay. Just a word on diksha. We have one meaning of diksha meaning bestowal of divya jnanam, transcendental knowledge, and destruction of sin. And that's the standard definition of diksha. Div for divya jnanam, cha for kshaya. Papasya, kshaya, destruction of sin, diksha. Divided up like we have mam sa means mom and sa, me and he. Today I'm killing you, tomorrow you'll kill me. That's mam sa. So diksha means getting divya jnanam, destroying papa, sin. Diksha. However, shiksha can also destroy sin and give, if obviously divya jnanam, if it's not divya jnanam, what use is it, shiksha? Someone can get a divya jnanam without having diksha also. A shiksha guru can give divya jnanam also. And we perform bhakti, we get klesha agni. So therefore, it's not the only that the diksha guru gives divya jnanam and papasya sankshaya. Huh? Shiksha guru can also give. Practices that can also give. So it's not the exclusive right of diksha guru that he gives that. So then what is the diksha guru giving? So in the Bhakti Sandarbha, after that verse, which is quoted there, in relation to Archana and Diksha. So the next verse says that therefore one should approach a guru and get the mantra from the guru, and that will establish one's relationship with Krishna. By which you get the divya jnanam and then the destruction of sin. So in other words, diksha, the qualifying element of diksha is not the divya jnanam and the papasya sankshayam, but the bestowal of the mantra, which is used for deity worship. This is in relation to Archana, he discusses this. So therefore, diksha is giving mantras, not Hare Krishna mantra, that's it, everybody gets that. But diksha guru is other mantras, which are secret, which you use for worshipping Krishna in Gauranga. So that's the distinction between diksha and shiksha, basically. They can both give shiksha, but the diksha guru gives the mantra. The mantra is important for deity worship. Well, as far as Pancharatra is concerned, it's always possible for women to take diksha. Vedically, generally they didn't. Though there are some exceptions to that also. That is, Upanayanam was not given to women. Huh? But there are cases where even some Gargi Acharya was a woman Acharya. Obviously she got Vedic knowledge, so she must have had some sort of initiation. So it wasn't general, but some people got. As for Pancharatra, those mantras, everyone can get. There's no restriction there at all. So anyone can get diksha, that not the Pancharatra diksha, anyone can get. Yeah. Well, it's a little complicated there. Yeah. Technically, one should only have one diksha guru. One cannot have two diksha gurus. In other words, one should not get mantras, secret mantras from two different gurus. That would mean that one would reject the first guru and take the second mantra or something like that. So we shouldn't do that. Unless the previous guru is very unqualified for some reason. Huh? And you have to reject him. But generally we should not reject the guru. So one should only take one, diksha guru. Shiksha we can take from many gurus and diksha from only one. Now we have a system here where we have first and second initiation, which is a little peculiar because there can only be one initiation. Huh? So we kind of like prolong the initiation into two parts, so to speak. And then for some reason, maybe someone has first from someone and second for someone else. So it's a little confusing there. So then the problem comes is, who is your Diksha Guru, the first one or the second one? Theoretically speaking, I would say that the one who gives you the mantra would be your Diksha Guru. That's my opinion. So I don't know other people's opinion on that. Because that's the defining element, is the giving of the mantra. So therefore, one who gives the mantra would be the one who would be your Diksha Guru. In most cases. But the Diksha Guru may not be the most important guru. The Shiksha Guru may have a predominance over the Diksha Guru in many cases. As in the case of Bhaktivinoda Thakur or Baladeva Dibhusan, for instance. The Shiksha Guru was more prominent than the Diksha Guru. Yeah. Well, we get mantras, some of which are Gayatri mantras. Gayatri mantras are a certain form of verse, with 888 syllables in it, which makes 24 syllables. We also get other mantras which are not 24 syllables. So those are the ones we use for deity worship. The others are for sandhya, meditation. If you're qualified. And you want to do deity worship. Well, generally it's recommended that one takes diksha. As we say here, diksha, shiksha, adi, one should take from guru. So generally it's recommended to take diksha, because the reason is that we can say, of course, that I'm just doing chant Hare Krishna and I get perfection that way, and you can. And you don't need diksha for that. Because the holy name is beyond diksha. These mantras, you need diksha. So then, why should we have a Diksha Guru? Jiva Goswami says, because the people of this material world have very fickle hearts and minds. And therefore, though theoretically we can just chant Hare Krishna, it is more favorable for our spiritual development to also do deity worship and engage all of our senses in worshiping the deity along with chanting Hare Krishna. That way we make connection between the holy name and the form of the Lord. So it's more favorable for us, and it steadies the heart, to also see the deity and engage in deity worship. Therefore, we should take diksha also and take the mantra and do deity worship in most cases. Yeah, anywhere. If you've got the mantras, then you do deity worship in the house or in the temple or wherever. What's that? If we don't do deity worship. Yeah, theoretically you don't know. Yeah. But it's recommended that generally we do deity worship, because later on he has five important elements. Powerful elements to get us to bhava are deity worship, chanting, hearing, five elements are there. Yeah. Yeah, generally for just attending programs, we don't need that. So in that way, we could say that it's a little obsolete, and many people don't do deity worship also. In our movement, people doing sankirtan, doing other things, and they can't, spend the time doing the deity worship. But here he has recommended, and generally one should do deity worship to steady the heart, the mind. We can say the one who has the mantra and doing it is bona fide. The one who's doing it without the mantras is not bona fide, according to Pancharatra. For Pancharatra worship, you should have the mantras and worship with the mantras. You want to have diksha, in other words, to worship the deities. That is Pancharatric standard. So that's a bona fide standard. Yeah. Even material knowledge, to some degree we can get. You can just read a book and get so much knowledge. I do that all the time. But there's certain aspects of even material knowledge which will not be transmitted by a book. And that's why, particularly in India, or even in the West, in order to become a good physicist, generally you go to MIT or some, place where they have all the Nobel Prize winning physicists there, and you'll want to learn from them something, whatever it is. And because there's certain things that perhaps you don't get by just study or book or whatever, and it's transmitted not even by word perhaps, simply by the presence of the person or whatever, they give you a little clue somehow or other, huh? Which may not even be spoken. Another example of music. Generally, a good musician will always have a good teacher. Yeah? Some famous teacher is also his teacher, a violin or whatever. They'll go to the most famous violinist and learn. Yeah? Because you can't learn from a book. And that teacher also will teach more to one person than he'll teach to another. If he sees you're enthusiastic and you're willing to learn and that, and you're not proud, then he'll teach you more. If you would say, I know everything already, then he won't be inclined to teach you anything. Yeah? He'll teach you something, but not everything he knows. And that person who he gets a little affection for, because he sees you want to learn, then he'll give you more. Yeah? So in India also, generally, all the music sampradayas are there, and they're not written. There's nothing written. Indian music is even different from Western, because nothing is written. In Western, you've got everything written. All the pieces are written and set out, at least. Nothing is written there in India. It's all, all the ragas and everything are in the mind, and it goes from the teacher to the disciple, and you'll not learn them. If you go to one guru, he'll teach you one. If you go to a different guru, he'll teach you different. And the guru won't even tell you all the ragas and all the different things about it unless he feels that you're qualified for it. So then you have to have devotion to the guru, and when you get more devotion, then you get more knowledge from him. So that even a material knowledge, there is some degree of that. You know, there has to be that sort of humility there. There's of course the Shiksha Guru, the prime Shiksha Guru is the Acharya, the founding Acharya. Like we have Prabhupada, and then in Madhvas they have Madhvacharya, and then they have some prominent Acharyas after that. So that's one type of Shiksha Guru. The other Shiksha Guru is the living Shiksha Guru, like the Diksha Guru is living. You have a Shiksha Guru is living. They can be many, whatever. But then again, we have to, let's say, distinguish, because everybody's giving Shiksha of some sort we associate with. Yeah? So generally we'll call the Shiksha Guru who won, the one who we regard with the same respect as we give the Diksha Guru. So those are the Shiksha Gurus. We have high regard for them, special high regard. And we get some special instruction from them. Those we consider the Shiksha Gurus.
Right,
I don't know. Because in Krishna Bhajanamrita there, Narahari says that one should give the same regard to the Shiksha Guru as one gives to the Diksha Guru. Equal respect. Well, Shiva Ram Swami's written a whole book on the Shiksha Guru also, emphasizing the importance of Shiksha. Now, there are people, also in ISKCON, who maintain that still there is something about Diksha which is special. But as far as Jiva Goswami, it looks as if he puts them on equal level, Shiksha and Diksha. And in fact, Diksha, he says, that is for people doing archana, and therefore we will give Diksha to our rich grihasthas. So they can do archana. And the rest can understand Hare Krishna. That's his implication in one place. So, in other words, he's putting more emphasis on the Bhagavat Vidhi of chanting the holy name and a little less emphasis on the Diksha there. No, it's still Shiksha there. Shiksha Guru is there still. Yeah. He doesn't say you don't have Diksha also, but you may put less emphasis on or on the Diksha Guru. You may have more emphasis on the Shiksha Guru. Anyway, there's, you know, a lot of opinions on this. So anyway, we have the first three elements there, yeah? The surrender, taking of knowledge and mantra, etc., guidance, and service to the guru, action. And The fourth one is to follow the Acharyas. Famous verse, Sruti Smriti Purana Adi Pancharatra Vidim Vina Akantiki Harer Bhakti Upatayaiva Kalpate. Following the previous Acharyas and the scriptures. That's number four. Five is to inquire about real dharma, sad-dharma pritcha. We should not be concerned about upadharmas or apadharmas or anything else. Contrary dharmas or contradictory things or secondary things. We should be concerned about sad-dharma. That is the real goal in life. And concerned about that mainly. And ask about that. We should give up enjoyment for Krishna's sake. This sounds a little bit general. Bhogachag, to give up material enjoyment. But we will see that that is a prerequisite. Qualification was atisakta, not to be too attached to the material world. So therefore, if we have strong desires to stay in the material world, it is very difficult to perform bhakti, because bhakti means essentially doing everything favorable for Krishna. So if we're attached to getting everything for ourselves, how can we give to Krishna favorably for his pleasure if we were thinking of myself all the time? So we have to have that willingness of doing for Krishna's pleasure, not for my pleasure. That's intrinsic in the very beginning of devotional service. To give up our enjoyment for Krishna's enjoyment. Very, very necessary. It's like the story of the boatman and the anchor. We have material attachment. We don't give it up. And no matter what we do, we stay in the same place. So therefore, all of our efforts will be wasted. In the beginning, we have this clear understanding that our willingness to give up the material enjoyment. We may not have it erased, but at least we're willing. We're trying to give it up. That much should be there. Willingness to give it up for Krishna's sake. Even if it's, there. Well, that's also, what's our definition? Anukuna Krishna Sivanam Ani Abhilashita Shunya. But, we also get Ananda. Sandra Nanda Visheshatma. We get concentrated bliss also. But the way of getting it is by complete surrender and giving everything to Krishna without anything for ourselves. So we can't think, if Krishna will give me the bliss, then I'll do it for him. And then it becomes conditional again. If I get Ananda, then I'll do this service for Krishna. Then it's conditional again. So our attitude has to be, just do for Krishna, because it's Krishna, that's all. I don't want to do for Krishna. Okay, so we give up everything for Krishna's sake. Live simply. Prerequisite also. Not just like giving everything for Krishna's sake. We have to live very simply. That means not depriving ourselves also. As much as is necessary to maintain oneself, one should take. So one should not artificially perform austerities, thinking that's pleasing to Krishna, or that it's better if I do more austerities and torture my body more. That's also not proper. And to take more than necessary, that's also not proper. So one should live to maintain proper mind and proper body. So that we can concentrate on Krishna. What is favorable for? Anukulna and Krishna Nasilam. That we do in terms of living. Live in a spiritual place. That's favorable for us. Live in a holy dham, for instance. Now, we can't all do that. That's mentioned later again. There's a particular anga called, living in the holy dham. This is a more general thing. Just live in a spiritual place. Observe vows, like Ekadasi, etc. In other words, we have to be willing to follow the rules and regulations, which require sometimes austerities of some sort, fasting, etc. So we have to be willing to submit ourselves to some degree to austerities. Not that we're completely austere, but we have to follow at least some basic rules and regulations. And respect the cows, brahmanas, vaishnavas, tulsi, etc. In the verse he actually quotes in relation to this, he says, one should respect the aswata tree or something like that. But if we look later on, and I think the 19th Anguilla says, one should not disturb any living entity. So this is the counterpart. One should respect all living entities, animals, people, Vaishnavas, Brahmanas, plants, Tulsi, everything. One should respect all living entities also. We're not trying to harass other living entities in our dealings. And particularly, of course, on the higher they go, we get more respect. So among the human beings, and the Vaishnava gets the most respect, and the Brahmana, the cow, and Tulsi, they all get high respect. But all living entities have to be given respect. And it's precisely because the demons don't do this that Krishna has to come and kill them all. Krishna comes to the material to kill the demons because they don't give respect to anybody. Okay? They harass everybody. So these are the positive angas, 10 angas. Then he gives the negative ones. Don't do this. Avoid asatsanga. Obviously, satsanga was up there with surrender to guru, etc. So this is avoid the opposite. That is, those people who are unspiritual, non-spiritual, and don't associate with those people. This is put in the first 20. Huh? That is the door. So then that means that this asatsanga is a very powerful influence on us, therefore we have to avoid it like anything. Otherwise, we cannot practice the hearing, chanting, remembering deity worship properly if we have asatsanga. Sangha means, in this case, association. Association does not mean just coming close to a person. That's also bad. But Sangha means intimate association, which means acting as an equal. I mean, friendly relationship. We establish a friendly relationship as an equal with a person. Then we begin to share. Anyone know a verse from Nectar of Instruction about this? Six types of Sangha. Giving and receiving knowledge, giving and receiving food, giving and receiving items, I think items. This is Sangha. It can be good Sangha in the case of with devotees. It can be bad Sangha in relation to materialists. So if we relate to materialists and we eat food, their food, we give them food and we eat their food, we give them things and they give us things, and we talk and back and forth and give knowledge back and forth, then we're going to get materialistic. Equal exchange is there in this Sangha. And this is the bad, this is the dangerous one. We act as equals. Okay. Of course, the exchange itself may influence. But more than that is that when we do this exchange, our mentality is equal. And when you're equal, then you're likely to get influenced very easily. Okay. If you treat them as an inferior, obviously you've got a little block there, so you don't get influenced. But if you think, oh, they're equal, we're friends, then you'll pick up his ideas and his perceptions and his values also very easily. Very, very easy to exchange. On the subtle level, we can say that in terms of subtle bodies, you have two subtle bodies and two gross bodies. When we establish a friendship, then you establish a link in the subtle bodies. When you do that, then the information can, everything can go back and forth very easily. There's like a little connection there, yeah? And you exchange very easily emotions, ideas, perceptions, everything will go very easily, imperceptibly even. So you can get influenced. So that's why it's very, very dangerous. Yeah? Asat Sangha, what does that mean? Asat, it means, of course, non-devotional, but it means one who is materialistic, meaning absorbed in sense gratification, sinful activities, illicit association with women, and breaking all the regular principles. It means one who is atheistic, rejecting God. It also means one who is an impersonalist, because they also are aparadis from the Vaishnava point of view. So all these are considered asat. Those rejecting God, those who are very sinful, those who are too attached to women, those are mayavadis, impersonalists, considered asat. So to establish a very friendly relationship with any of these types, then you will get influenced and adopt their mentality and values. And so therefore this is to be avoided. On the other hand, we associate with those people who have emotional consciousness, then we also get we get that influence. So satsanga is encouraged, asatsanga we have to avoid. Next item is to avoid bahu shastra, too many shastras. This looks a little contradictory because up there we have shiksha, take shiksha, and here we say don't take shiksha. So, meaning of this is, there are several restrictions here why we say this. One is our intentions. If our intention is to earn money from it, then it is bad. Even if it's bona fide shastra. If we're trying to get money out of it, bad intention. Huh? One is to make a living off learning shastra. Other is to learn shastra in order to defeat others or to argue. And that's not our purpose. Our purpose is to convince people, rather than argue with them and defeat them. Huh? But to convince people, or for our own faith, increase of faith, we do that. Yeah? Because we have the Uttamadhikari there who is very knowledgeable of shastra. It's good for us. Yeah? But the mode of simply to defeat others and become famous, that is not our purpose. Therefore, that is fun. Also, shastra should not be... we don't learn shastras which are non-devotional. In other words, we don't learn all the non-essential things. Yeah? Devotional shastras are good, but other shastras we don't learn. So therefore, avoid this excessive knowledge of shastras for the wrong reasons. Yeah? But the alternative is we should take shiksha, we should take good shastra from the proper sources. That's bona fide. Okay. Then one is, don't take disciples, excessive disciples. But here, of course, up above we have the guru. The guru is giving, making a disciple, diksha. Take diksha. Somebody has to give it, obviously. Here is, don't take disciples. So that is explained because, in the sense that we don't take unqualified disciples simply for material reasons. We don't take followers, spiritual followers, for material reasons. People who are unqualified, we accept them simply for material reasons. We don't do that. At the same time, it is recognized that we have to increase the sampradaya. Therefore, there must be disciples. But they should be qualified and initiated for the proper reasons, not the improper reasons. And that is bona fide. Of course, one who is learning, obviously is not going to be a guru anyway. He's at the beginning of devotional service. He's not going to become a guru immediately. These are prerequisites. But at least all along the line, that should not be our ambition to make disciples. That's not our purpose. In the beginning or in the end, even if we are initiating, that's not our purpose, simply to make disciples. rather than make disciples, our whole purpose is to serve Krishna, that's all. And engage others in serving Krishna. Then there's another restriction. Don't avoid projects, excessive projects, big projects. That is so because it can also be a distraction. If an example is given, ashrama, for instance, ashrama, that's the example given there, to build a big ashrama. So, if we get involved in that, which is a material endeavor in the sense that it requires manpower, skills, materials, money, and then we can get distracted from Krishna. So therefore, if it becomes a distraction, it becomes unfavorable. So that's why it's said here. At the same time, we see that if it is not a distraction, then it can be done. And we see, for instance, the Goswamis basically weren't interested. But nevertheless, we see big temples. Madana Mohan Temple or Radha Govinda Temple, very big temples. They didn't become distracted. So therefore, this rule doesn't apply. Why? Because other people did it for them. People were enthusiastic for the glorification of the deity and for preaching, whatever. And they could still concentrate on their bhajan. So therefore, it was allowed. As far as it becomes distractive, and therefore it's not good.
Prabhupada was giving an example from Australia. They were talking about this huge problem. And then it was so deep and so expensive, in the end, that he did it. No one told the story about a man who wanted his earrings that were wounded for the most unmarried altar, and really heavy. And some of the long time they stayed up for the final result, but they put it in the ears, and I said, hey, it's a heavy pain.
For like an anartha, in other words. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that one wants to engage in a project, one will be qualified with manpower, with finances, with proper lifespan, with intelligence, etc. Otherwise, it becomes a big burden on you. And you become very distracted. Avoid unkindness towards others. One should, he says that, kripana, don't be a kripana. Don't be miserly. So in ordinary dealings, one should be, generous in dealings with others. Ordinary dealings. Avoid soka adi, he says. Soka, lamentation, illusion, anger, envy. These should be avoided. Of course, we know that no one's pure. We have an artist to begin with. But we should not. We should have some restriction on these things as devotees, and we should not just say, "Well, I'm going to become purified, so now it's all right for me to become angry as much as I want." We have to put some restriction on these emotions, negative emotions. That's another thing we shouldn't be taken advantage of by other people. In other words, kindness doesn't mean just you let everybody step on you also. It doesn't mean that. We have to be intelligent also. We have to be discreet, intelligent in how we... And it looks like charity. Charity is given, but given to the proper person, not at the proper time. We don't give to everybody. That's in the mode of goodness. Avoid disrespect of devatas. In other words, we respect all living entities, so we shouldn't disrespect the devatas. They're also living entities. And also, they're servants of Krishna, so we don't disrespect them. We don't worship them directly, but we don't disrespect them also. So the proper mode of respect is we offer the remnants of Krishna or Vishnu to the devatas. That we can do. And we understand their place. They're also servants of Krishna, so we don't disrespect them. Avoid aparads, that's seva aparads and nam aparads. And in Nectar Devotion there, there's quotes from different Puranas, lists of seva aparads and of course, 10 nam aparads are very famous. And there's a list of seva aparads from different Puranas given. Seva aparad means offense towards the deity form of the Lord, such as going into the deity room with your shoes on or being unclean and touching the deity, basically regarding the deity. So that's aparad in relation to Krishna, the Lord. Nam aparad is in relation to the holy name. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's actually four types. Nam aparad, and he says that includes not only the name, but any type of bhakti. So we got nam aparad, offense against the process of bhakti. We got seva aparad, that's offense against the deity, or Krishna, or the Supreme Lord. So offense against the process, offense against the Lord, offense against the Vaishnava aparad, he puts in a separate category. In other words, offense against the Lord, offense against the devotee of the Lord, offense against the process of bhakti. And then he has against the jiva, jiva aparad, against living entities in general. He says four types of aparad are there. So anyway, here's mentioned two, seva aparads and nam aparads. And within the nam aparads, of course, we do get also Vaishnava aparad mentioned, like sadhu ninda and guru or vagya, or both say sadhu Vaishnava aparad also. And avoid aparadis, those who are offenders. We avoid aparads ourselves, and we have to avoid people who are aparadis, who are offending. We avoid those people. And avoid violence towards other living entities. We should respect all of them. Just as I said, the last element there was to respect the cow and the tulsi, etc. So we avoid violence towards any living entity. So these are the first 20. These are general principles one should follow in relation to practicing the other 44 angas of devotion. We should try to follow them. Then these angas become effective. Now, all these angas are followed, but again, we have to keep in mind the basic principle, that is, ani abhilashana shunya, anukulena krishnana silanam. That's the general principle. And then we have the other one, according to Shastra. That's for Vaidhi Bhakti. And then we have all the different angas, and we have the first 20 angas we have to follow. So, it is not simply chanting or whatever. We have all these conditions under which we chant. And then it becomes effective. And it's called bhakti. Okay. Well, I said not particularly devotees. Anyone who's aparadi, one of those aparadis, not necessarily a devotee aparadi. It could be a demon aparadi also, like Kamsa. They're all aparadis. So we avoid all aparadis, those who offend Krishna or the Vaishnavas or the holy name. Then it's better to avoid. Better to avoid. Oh, yeah. Well, we have to bear that. We can explain to them, try to preach to them that this is the reason why. But if it's unfavorable for our spiritual development, then we'll have to avoid. So you can try the other thing, that is we can try preaching to them also, and have good association, influence them so they become better. That's also there, as far as devotees are concerned. Well, I think ultimately the only thing we can do is estimate or judge the influence that they have upon our devotional service and see if it's favorable or unfavorable. And if we find ourselves going down, then we have to say, think it was an unfavorable influence, that's all. We have to be honest like that. And if they can't see that, then what can we do? We cannot, of course, come to the opposite conclusion and condemn people unnecessarily also. We shouldn't do that. We have to show compassion and try to rectify others and correct them. Where they cannot be corrected, that's another case. And then we have to avoid if it is unfavorable for us in our devotional development. But that's also we have freedom in devotional service also. So, Well, that's natural. So that is nothing wrong with that. Other people may be a little sensitive, that's all. But what can we do about that? Yeah. Like-minded is there. I was going to mention that also. Yeah, that's in association. It says that those who are like-minded. Of course, that means one, like-minded means, what is it, Snigda and Sarasiki and something, I think three terms. Yeah? So anyway, like-minded in one sense means, of course, that they should be Vaishnavas and they should be in the same sampradaya, same beliefs, etc. The other is there should be an affectionate relationship between them, Snigda. So that some sort of empathy should be there, obviously. And you cannot artificially create that also. So there's just some feelings we have between each other, and they'll be closer with other people than others. So we can't predict what that's going to be. And so that's some just natural thing. Oh, yeah. Well, one initiates somebody not because he has no faith. And basically, the qualification is faith, yes? Sincere faith. So if someone gets initiated, we don't know if he has faith or not, but he has a lot of money, so I'll initiate him because he's going to give me a big donation. That would be unbona fide initiation. Well, there are a lot of materialistic people in the material world also. They're thinking, I will get something out of this initiation in terms of advantage, or if I join ISKCON, then I can get a good position and exploit it and rob them of money or steal the money. So they may do that. We see that people come and they look like devotees, but they're actually thieves. They join and then they steal something and run away. So they're acting like devotees, and we don't know sometimes. And that's why people give them things, and whatever's happened in Mayapur, even, and they run off with lakhs of rupees sometimes. You give them things to do, and then they run off with all the money. We think they're devotees. We think they're sincere. They're serving and everything. They're chanting Hare Krishna, and suddenly they disappear with the money. That means they didn't have a good motive at all, and they came for that, and they're going. So we don't know all the time. So that's why the guru has to be very careful also. That's why the restriction is that one should actually observe for some time, let's say a year at least, to see if he's really sincere or not. Even then, it may not show up. Yeah. Or a person may be sincere, but then he may also become insincere at a certain period of time. So it's a little bit difficult sometimes to tell. So, unqualified people may get initiated. So the guru always can't tell. It's not always his fault either, because, you know, some people can hide themselves in so many ways. So as much as possible, we have to take precautions, that's all. The guru should take precautions as much as possible. So? That's in what relations to what, parents or something? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, in other words, we keep a little distance. We don't get completely involved. If we get emotionally involved again, then definitely we're going to be influenced. So even if we live with them for some time, we should be a little distant. Otherwise, if they're devotees, there's no problem. If they're not devotees, if we get too close, then we start emotional relationships again, then definitely we're going to get influenced. And we feel obliged for many things. We get more and more bondage. We have to do this for them, that for them. And we get really overcome. Keep a little distant. Even if we're living in the same place. As far as preaching. Yeah, we're giving mercy. We're preaching to the innocent people. So in a sense, it's like the Madhyam preaching to the Kanishta. Like that. They're innocent. So we're putting them on a lesser level. We're giving them something. We're giving them knowledge. So they are in a lesser position in that sense. Even though materially they're higher, spiritually they're lower. And so we have to recognize the spiritual, they're spiritually lower. Therefore we're giving them knowledge. We should not think they're superior, and then we'll start getting their material values instead. Yeah? So spiritually we think it's lower, therefore we give them spiritual knowledge. And that way we don't get affected. Okay, I guess we can end there. Okay, Hare Krishna.